Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Hezri Adnan. I'm the Senior Director of Research at ISIS Malaysia. Thank you for making your way to this building at 3 p.m. and after lunch. But I'm sure you will stay awake because we have a very interesting presentation today. This is actually a joint forum between ISIS Malaysia and ICIC, ICRC, International Committee of the Red Cross. And we are privileged today to have with us Air Commodore Bill Boothby. He's an Associate Fellow at the Geneva Center for Security Policy. And I was told that you're from the UK, but there's some Irish lineage to your name. No.
Oh, no.
No.
Make no claims for that.
Make no claims for that, yes. Yeah. So that's my first blunder for today. So the topic for today is cyber operations in war and peacetime, fundamental issues and critical reflections. There's been an intense debate over the years over perhaps two models of internet governance or cybersecurity governance, whether it should be state-based or, you know, global-based, multi-stakeholder institutions. I guess for those who are against the idea of securitization of the internet, you may be wondering why are we governing a space which is supposed to be global digital commons, global public good, who are supposed to, you know, securitize this domain. But I think that's why we're going to have Bill Boothby with us today to enlighten us on the need and also the latest development on cyber operations and cyber governance, cyber security governance. And then after about 40 minutes of presentation, we will have Ms. Sharifa Rashida Said Osman, who's the Director of Cybersecurity Policy International Cooperation Division, National Cybersecurity Agency, NACSA. I believe this is a one-year-old institution and which the government has just established. I think you will have about 10 minutes after Bill has, you know, shared his thoughts. Without further ado, I would like to invite Bill Boothby to share your thoughts on this topic, please.
Thank you very much. Does my voice carry? Or do I need to use a microphone? Whichever. Or the stand. My trouble is I like wandering around. That's the
Can we fit with a cordless on?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Let's go with the flow. It's a great privilege to be here, and thank you very much for the arrangements and for the invitation. It's marvellous. A few words about me, a very few words. I'm from the UK. I spent 30 years working as a lawyer for the UK Royal Air Force, and on retirement decided that slippers and daytime TV wasn't really going to cut it, where I was concerned. And as a result, wonderful. Problem solved. Yes, great. And decided that therefore the answer was to try doing some teaching, try doing some writing, and I'm on my sixth or seventh book. And that's what brings me here, essentially. Because in my past, I was involved in the group that put together the first of the two Tahlil manuals, Tahlil Manual 1.0, which came out, I think it was 2013, okay? That's the one that was involved in cyber warfare law specifically, as opposed to the second Tahlil manual, which took things much more broadly and looked at peacetime applications of law to the cyber domain. So what I'm going to try and do is cover a few thoughts that have occurred to me as a result of being involved in the Tahlil manual process, but also being involved in Track 1.5 discussions with the Chinese over a period of a couple of years, being involved in some discussions involving the Russians on the odd occasion, and just generally looking at what's going on in the cyber context. They're personal reflections. I don't represent anybody other than myself, and you're perfectly at liberty to have your own views and to think that what I'm talking about is less than entirely useful. However, my hope is that one or two of the thoughts that I can offer, though not necessarily things that you would agree with, will spark thoughts which themselves may prove to be useful to you. I thought I'd start by talking to you about ideas of a spectrum of conflict. The idea that what we have is no longer a pure situation of war and peace, but actually we have a number of grades or levels, if you like, of situation going from at one end of the spectrum, full all-out international armed conflict involving sovereign states, to at the other end of the spectrum, what we would call peace. Peace can encompass some remarkably unpeaceful circumstances, as I think I'll demonstrate in a moment. So, cyber warfare law would specifically apply in the context of either an international or a non-international armed conflict. Armed conflict in the sense of either any confrontation between states involving the use of its armed force, their armed forces, or a situation within a state in which either there are armed groups fighting against one another, or there are armed groups fighting, or an armed group fighting against the governmental forces, and where the armed group concerned is organized and a certain minimum level of intensity of operations has been achieved. Any of those situations would trigger the application of the law of armed conflict. And the position that was taken in the Tallinn Manual is that those situations could apply in the cyber context, and therefore that it is legitimate to discuss the application of existing legal rules in the context of cyber. But I will deal with that aspect, whether the underlying philosophy that drove the Tallinn Manual and its conclusions is realistic or non-realistic, as we go through the talk. But below warfare, we have a number of other situations to think about. We have the idea of cyber intervention. In other words, cyber interference by one state in what are preserved internal activities of another state. But not just interference, interference coupled with the intention to coerce, a coercive intent. You need those two factors together for you to be dealing with a situation of intervention as such. Below that, you have notions of interference. Notions where, or situations in which a state is interfering in what is going on in another state. It may not necessarily be a state interfering with the activities of the state itself. It could be interfering with commercial activities of commercial undertakings situated within that other state. The point is that there is interference going on, and that interference itself can constitute a situation known to international law. Sort of below that, but not necessarily, but a situation which could also span within some of the other situations I've just described, is the notion of cybercrime. Because those who are undertaking a number of these activities will also be breaching the domestic law of the affected state, and therefore be committing a cybercrime. It may be a cybercrime where nothing realistically can be done about it, because it may be difficult or impossible to commence proceedings simply because the individuals concerned are not located within the effective jurisdiction of the relevant state. That doesn't stop it from being cybercrime. So that's another aspect to think about. And cybercrime is something that we see plentifully played out on the world stage. It's very revealing to view the cyber reports that have been issued weekly by the International Institute for Strategic Studies and which show the extent of cyber activity globally at quite a horrifying level. The final bullet on this slide makes the very relevant point that the edges between these various levels of activity that I've been talking about are not bright lines. They are fuzzy edges. Therefore, you have a tendency for notions of cybercrime to merge into a number of the other activities that I've talked about. You have a fuzzy edge between crime and cyber interference. You have a degree of ambiguity in determining whether cyber interference is only interference or whether there is a coercive intent taking the activity into the sphere of intervention. And then, of course, you've got warfare and the ambiguity over whether a situation is truly a non-international armed conflict or whether actually it constitutes a conflict between states. Ideas of hybrid warfare, which I'll mention in due course, clearly illustrate the point that I'm making there. Still in the preliminary stage, and not wishing to threaten you with this being a 5-hour lecture, although it could be, so don't look too complacent. Recognize, if you will, there is the basic prohibition on the threat or use of force. The reference for that is Article 2, Paragraph 4 of the United Nations Charter. Remember, if you will, that the United Nations Charter is all about the maintenance of international peace and security. And therefore, the Article 2, Paragraph 4 prohibition is core to the realization of that overriding intent or purpose. It's very easy to say that, but this was in many ways one of the first issues that we had to address when we were doing the preliminary thinking towards the preparation of the Tallinn Manual 1.0. What is the use of force? What is the meaning of a use of force in the cyber context? Indeed, what is force in the cyber context? Does the idea that the International Court of Justice used in its determination as to whether or not there is an armed attack, namely the application of notions of scale and effects, do those ideas have an application in the context of cyber? Is it scale and effects of what is being done, or is it scale and effects of the consequences? If you think about how conventional events are interpreted by reference to whether there has been a use of force or whether there has been an armed attack, you will readily come, I suggest, to the conclusion that it is the effects that matter, because it's the effects that you see, it's the effects that you witness, it's the effects that therefore in practice will influence a decision of a state as to whether it has been the subject of an armed attack or whether it has been the subject of a use of force. Therefore, we came to the conclusion that scale and effects will actually be the relevant criteria in both of those situations. Breaches of Article 2.4, i.e. unlawful use of force, and armed attack for the purposes of triggering the inherent right of all states to use self-defense individually or collectively. I've used the word perception. The perception that is going to matter in that determination as to whether or not there's been a use of force or an armed attack, in my view, is going to be the perception of the victim state. It's going to be how the victim state sees it. Therefore, we came to the conclusion that it was helpful to put forward a series of criteria that we thought victim states in practice are going to apply in determining whether there has been a use of force or an armed attack. Those criteria have, by some international law experts, been completely misinterpreted as being legal criteria. They obviously are not. All they are what we said that they are, namely the sorts of thing that we think that states in practice are going to be considering when determining whether they've been the subject of an armed attack or a use of force. The severity, the military nature, the directness of the consequences, and so on and so forth. All of the 7 or 8 criteria that we put together. I think there's another factor I would throw in, and it's this, and this is a personal view or a personal question that I ask myself as follows. Can you directly read across in terms of severity from a kinetic event to a cyber event? Can you say that a particular consequence in terms of numbers of casualties, nature of casualties, amount of damage, that you would regard as being a use of force if it inflicted kinetically, is necessarily going to be seen as a use of force if inflicted by cyber means? And I have a suspicion that the answer to that question is no, although in the Tarlin manual we hint that the answer is yes. I suspect that the answer is no for the following reason. Namely, we're all at it. We're all at it in the sense of using cyber technologies to interfere with one another. We're all at it in terms of using cyber technologies to spy on one another. We're all at it in terms of using cyber technologies for activities that we would probably rather were not reprinted on the front page of the Daily Telegraph or the Straits Times. So I would suggest it's possible that the consequences would need to be more severe in connection with a cyber operation to be regarded either as use of force or an armed attack than would be the case for a corresponding kinetic operation. I just think that because of perceptions. I think, therefore, that the perception word runs in a variety of directions and involves or requires a considerable degree of thought. I then ask, what is law? Because I readily accept or believe that I have a mixed audience. I'm not talking to lawyers, so I'm trying to avoid legal speak. And you'll tell me afterwards I failed completely. Well, fair enough. What is law? International law. You've got hard law. You've got notions of treaties. You've got formal agreements between states reduced into writing and intended to bind at the legal level. Treaties. And then you've got ideas of what states actually generally do, believing that they are obliged to behave in that sort of way. In 2 sentences, I've described to you the 2 core sources of international law, treaty law and what is called customary law, based on the general practice of states, as I said, plus what, and you're bound to get a little bit of Latin because it's a legal talk, opinio iuris, a belief in legal obligation to behave in that way. Those are the 2 sources of law. I mention them for the following reason. It seems to me that we have such a situation of conflict in terms of interpretation of these issues between what you could loosely describe as the Western view and what you could loosely describe as the Eastern view as characterized by China and Russia. We have such a difference of interpretation between those 2 groupings, as it were, that there seems to be little prospect of customary law emerging in the foreseeable future in any detailed sense. The other obstructions to customary law emerging are that so much of what is actually done is done secretively and is then denied. Okay, so I see the emergence of customary law as being fundamentally difficult. I also see the emergence of treaty law as being fundamentally difficult simply because the various states would be coming at any treaty negotiation with such an opposing interpretation of the way in which law ought to be applied, or indeed as to the degree in which there is a requirement for new law, that there would be obstacles, fundamental obstacles to making progress. So what I'm suggesting on this slide is that the development of soft legal instruments, whether in the form of manuals, whether in the form of guidelines, whether in the form of best practice documents and things of that nature, may well be the way ahead, initially at least, put together by the like-minded. So what is the legal status of the Ptahlin manuals? And let's put the positives and the negatives. The positives were it's undoubtedly got some quality scholarship. I don't include myself, but certain of my colleagues certainly are quality scholars. It was populated by international experts. They were addressing how the rules apply, okay? So they weren't just putting together a set of legal rules and saying, this is the law, take it or leave it. But what they were doing is also seeking to illustrate the application of legal rules to the cyber context by specifically devising cyber examples. The rules that were found and that were printed as black letter rules in bold in the Ptahlin manual do have the consensus support of the experts who participated in the process, and therefore the wording was adjusted in order to obtain that consensus, because it's the consensus of the participating experts that we always thought lended credibility to the conclusions that were reached. And finally, and quite significantly, we included a discussion of the law applicable to the resort use of force, which is this jus ad bellum referred to on the final slide, as well as the law relating to the conduct of hostilities during an armed conflict in the same document. When we had our very preliminary meeting before we finally kicked the process off to start it, we were very concerned about the extreme difficulty in dealing with jus ad bellum, the resort to the use of force part of the law. But on the other hand, we also very rapidly came to the conclusion that if we didn't address that body of law, we would be failing those who were looking for some sort of legal guidance. Because when we started, there was the history of the operations against Estonia in 2007 and against Georgia in 2008, and not much else. And the world wanted some sort of guidance on how the law could be made applicable in the cyber context. So much for the positives. What about the negatives? Ptahlin 1 is not a global process. It was basically states from the NATO background. Russia and China criticized the approach. The Russia and Chinese view, where Ptahlin is concerned, is that we pre-positioned the conclusion, and that that is a fallacious way in which to proceed when you're looking at a situation such as this. They feel that we were ignoring differences of view in relation to fundamental issues such as sovereignty. That's a very, very important issue where China is concerned. Their view is that sovereign rights extend to the internet itself and to cyberspace itself, as opposed to extending to activities undertaken within a state's territory and the physical components of the internet that are located there, the computers, the cables, the servers, and so on and so forth. The fundamental view in Russia and China is that there is a need for ad hoc law dealing with cyber activities. That is the way they see it. Therefore, they do not accept the fundamental assumption, if you like, or supposition that underpinned the cyber, the Ptahlin manual thinking, which is that international law, as we currently apply it and know it, is perfectly capable of being applied in the cyber context. That is what the Ptahlin manual sought to demonstrate, and that is what the Russians and the Chinese have been rejecting. So what do we have on the UN side? We have the Group of Governmental Experts process, which was established pursuant to a United Nations General Assembly resolution. There are reports from that process which have been published in 2010, 2013, and 2015. And if you look at those reports, and then if you look at the Tallinn Manual, the enormous difference is readily identifiable. Namely, that within the Tallinn Manual, you see detailed rules set forth together with detailed commentaries associated with each rule, explaining the legal provenance of the relevant rule, and then explaining where the participating experts agreed and disagreed as to interpretation or application of the rule. What you get with the Group of Governmental Experts process is infinitely less detail. You have propositions and proposals rather than identified rules. And you have, shall we say, very much less in the way of practical guidance to states as to how to conduct themselves in cyberspace. The reports of the Group of Governmental Experts share something with the Tallinn Manual, namely a status at law. That is, that neither is an actual source of law. I told you earlier that sources of law consist of the general practice of states supported by this legal obligation aspect and treaties. They are neither treaties nor are they general practice of states. They are the opinions of experts operating in their individual personal capacities. So they are not sources of law. They are talking about the law, but that's as far as it goes in both cases. So the recommendations that have come out of the Group of Governmental Experts reports have been recommendations on confidence building measures, on norms, and on rules. And they have been relatively low level recommendations. However, there are several positives. The positive of the Group of Governmental Experts process is that it is more globally representative, in the sense that it draws on states from different constituencies within the world in terms of approach to cyber issues. So it's far more representative than Tallinn. But there is infinitely less granularity in terms of the rules that they have found, and therefore less guidance and less specificity. And then we have the significant point that there was great hope in 2016 that the next GGE process was going to rectify these issues by providing more detailed guidance. And instead of that happening, unfortunately, the group broke up without achieving a report at all. And indeed, with certain mutterings suggesting that so far as certain participating experts were concerned, some of that which had been put together in the previous reports should no longer be relied upon as being a consensus view. So the collective process, arguably, as of now, has not been wildly successful. Let's put it that way. I would hesitate to suggest that it's a complete failure, because there are certain things that have come out of the process. So the 2013 Group of Governmental Experts report recommended that states, for example, and these are only examples, you can get the reports on the internet, you can read through the reports, and you can form your own conclusions, and feel free to disagree with what I'm putting before you. It's just, as I said at the beginning, a personal view. But suggested that states should abide by international law in cyberspace. But you've got to think about what that means very carefully. Yes, they should abide by international law in cyberspace, but if we're not agreeing what international law is in cyberspace, it's a bit of an empty observation. That states should honour state responsibility norms for cyber attacks from their territory. I think we all agree about that. Then we move on to the 2015 report, which was, on balance, one of the more specific, well, the more specific report of the three. That sovereignty applies to state ICT as information and communication technologies. They can't bring themselves to refer to the word cyber or the prefix cyber, therefore they talk about ICT. What's in a word? Sovereignty applies to the activities and to the territorial jurisdiction. Okay. Now that's fine. What it leaves out is applying jurisdiction issues to portions of cyberspace as such. That's what the Chinese would like to see, that's what the Russians would like to see included, it's what the Americans are not prepared to agree to. It agrees the proposition or recommendation is that existing international law obligations apply to state use of information and communication technologies. That could be interpreted as progress, were it not for the unwillingness to spell out how existing international law obligations apply, what rules that therefore implies exist, and so on. That the UN Charter applies in its entirety, that's the high water mark. That undoubtedly represents progress. That the UN Charter applies. Great. And then, the low water mark. That the principles of humanity, necessity, proportionality, and distinction were only noted. Only noted isn't saying anything about whether one says that they apply, whether one says that they don't apply. It implies that the experts in the GGE process are agnostic on those issues. There are some obvious legal challenges when you are looking at the whole idea of cyber activity and when you are trying to apply the law to such activities. The idea of cyber attack always was a challenge. How does the word or notion of an attack apply in the cyber context? The view we took in Tallinn was that it applies because the cyber event has the consequences that an attack would have. In just the same way that if you drop a bomb on a building, you smash something up. If you were to use a cyber technique to cause damage or to cause casualties, why on earth would that not be regarded as an attack? There are those who argue that taking that view is applying an analogy. My argument would be no, it's not applying an analogy. What it is explaining is why cyber attacks are attacks. They are a subset of attack. There is no analogy involved because what you are using is a technique in order to inflict injury or damage. After all, if you take a rifle and if you use the rifle to fire a weapon, fire a bullet at a target, what are you actually doing? That. You're triggering the trigger. You're flicking the trigger. And what are you then doing? You are setting in motion a sequence of events. And that sequence of events gives rise to the passage of that bullet through a medium called the air until it reaches a target where it will then cause injury or damage. If you are sending malware on its way, what are you doing? You're not doing that, you're doing that. That's the big difference. You're pressing the enter key. You are then releasing the malware. The malware passes through a medium called cyberspace. The malware reaches a target called the targeted computer system. And when it reaches that target, it then causes an alteration in the ones and the noughts, and as a result, damage or injury. If it does cause that damage or injury, why should it not be regarded as an attack? And why should the instrumentality that you use to achieve that outcome not be regarded as a cyber weapon in just the same way as a conventional weapon is characterized? But then there are other challenges. Does data get to be an object? I mean, you're really going to appreciate, maybe he was right when he said this is going to be a 3-hour presentation. Data as an object, sorry, I can talk endlessly about this. Data as an object is a problem. Is data an object or not? Why do we care whether data is an object? Answer, because if you are saying that to characterize an event as a cyber attack, you need to have caused death, injury, damage, or destruction, and we were saying that. What is damage? What is damage if the only effect is on the targeted computer system? You haven't had a death injury effect on people. You haven't damaged some other object. But what you have done is wrecked the data on the targeted computer system, which may well have been your purpose. Is that data an object such as to characterize the event as an attack or not? That was the challenge. Oh my goodness. Okay. Then we have problems with geographical issues, neutrality, notions of neutrality, notions of blockade, notions of zones. Does geography make any sense in cyberspace was another question. Undoubtedly, one of the issues that lies at the root of differences of view between ourselves and the Russians and Chinese is notions of a national information space. The Russians and Chinese absolutely consider that they have sovereign rights and jurisdiction in relation to a national information space, and in just the same way as they see other forms of data coming within that notion, so they also see cyber activities. So that all led to the question, is international law adequate? And we based our view that international law could adequately deal with much activity in cyberspace on certain core notions. The notion about attacks, the notion about weapons, the International Law Commission, the International Court of Justice judgment in the Nuclear Weapons Advisory opinion saying that, in their view, basic principles of distinction apply irrespective of the technology that is employed in conflict. So on that basis, we thought, yes, our view made sense. In peacetime, we have intellectual property theft, we have political hacking, and the US election allegations are, of course, quite significant. I could talk quite a lot about that, maybe in Q&A. Estonia 2007 was not an armed attack. It was not a use of force. It was the defacing of websites and the like. Commercial espionage, we have seen all too much of in the cyber context. Anti-corporate sabotage, we are seeing quite a lot of in the cyber context. And it's quite significant that states do not seem to be characterizing that as a use of force or an armed attack either. So criminal law enforcement is going to be quite a significant part of the technique, it seems to me, for dealing with many of the cyber threats that confront us. Whether we're dealing with intervention or interference, there is, in my view, going to be a preference in many states to dealing with these threats as a law enforcement issue. But does the war peace regime apply in cyberspace? Does it make sense? Or do cyber activities facilitate hybrid warfare of the sort which makes the distinction between peace and war very difficult to define in any reliable and sensible way? And if they do, what are we going to do about this? How are we going to devise our own strategies and our own policies if we feel that the divide between war and peace has become even more fuzzy than it has been in the past? because we're dealing with ambiguous legal situations. In just the same way as it was ambiguous what was going on when the Little Green Men intervened in parts of Ukraine. So it's going to be even more ambiguous when we don't know who is posing the cyber threat to us because of the anonymity associated with much cyber activity and because of the ability to route, R-O-U-T-E, cyber action through other sources, other linkages, and make it appear that somebody other than yourself has been actually engaged in this. So the big question for somebody like me is how are states such as yours and such as others going to interpret these things? Big question. I should mention the code of practice issued by Russia and China in 2015, a proposed code of conduct referring to responsible state behavior, compliance with the UN Charter, and talking about international peace and security. And then finally, I think I wanted to talk about the Internet of Things. Because undoubtedly the proliferation of smart devices is posing challenges. This is very much in the peacetime environment. Data may or may not be personal data. What is the concept of personal data these days in an environment in which young people, and maybe not so young people, are prepared to disclose so much of themselves publicly via organisations such as Instagram, Facebook, and so on and so forth? What is, therefore, that notion of personal privacy, which some argue ought to be the counterbalance to intrusiveness by the state in seeking to understand where threats lie of a security nature? Does that balance shift as the domestic population becomes more prepared to share private data about itself, or what those of us of my age would regard as private data, more publicly? Or, notwithstanding that one is prepared to share intimate details with one's mates on Facebook, does one still have a very fine-tuned view of what one's own privacy consists of, and therefore maybe things haven't changed quite as much as some of us imagine they have? There is certainly a trade-off in the Internet of Things between price associated with your new washing machine, air conditioning system, central heating system where I come from, or whatever, and security arrangements. If you take all of the information that comes through into this notion of the Internet of Things, it has the capacity to tell you an awful lot about individuals. How do we deal with the legal challenges that raises? How do we try to ensure the integrity of individuals in an environment where that sort of information is available and may therefore be very, very difficult to safeguard? It's very easy for national organizations to say, oh, we will look after your data, and then it's only 6 months later that news of the data breach comes out and people's confidence is eroded. Maybe we're in a situation in which that sort of information needs to be very, very closely safeguarded. Otherwise, the population's willingness to see these new ways of doing things continue and be developed may wane. Has the state taken adequate measures to secure respect for an individual's private life? That would be the question that might well form the basis for a legal challenge. And the legal challenge could well prove to be extremely expensive to answer and deal with. I think there are huge challenges there and they need thinking about. And then you've got, of course, those who are seeking to profit from this sort of thing. We had the Vault 7 revelations, the CIA Weeping Angel program, where data can be got from your false off setting of your television, which then proceeds to listen to what you're talking about in your living room and report it to people you know not whom. Remote hacking of smartphones. We see this we see this difficult balance between privacy on the one hand and the well-recognized need of the security services to know where the next national security threat is going to come from. We see this difficult challenge played out. And where is it most usually played out? Answer: in national legislation. It's national legislation which will show where each individual state has decided to place the line of acceptability. And I think that that is going to be something which is very individual to a particular country. It's going to be individual in the sense that the degree of the threat, the nature of the threat, the source of the threat, the degree to which the threat is using these advanced technologies and so on is not going to be identical from country to country. So it's got to be in your own national legislation where you place this balance point, this pinch point. But it's got to be a pinch point which adequately, in my view, respects and reflects and protects the rights of the individual. Because if you don't do that, you run the risk of losing the respect of individuals, and that could cause the whole edifice to come crashing down. Conclusions. Only basic rules come from an inclusive process such as GGE, and sometimes no rules at all. Much less granularity. If you get exclusive like-minded groups together, then you're going to get much more detail. But in many ways, that's just a statement of the obvious. And then existing law, it seems to me, has to be the yardstick of legal acceptability. New customary or treaty law is very unlikely to materialise, I think, certainly in the foreseeable future. I think you're only going to get new treaty law, potentially, if there is a disaster of some sort. And how bad the disaster would need to be, I worry about, given what you can see in terms of ongoing activities at the moment. There are differences of view between the West and China and Russia. They may narrow. I think potentially the Chinese may come towards the Western view. Increasingly, if the Chinese see that ongoing irresponsible activity in cyberspace is not in the interests of a commercially dependent nation, they are going to see the merit, I think, in an orderly approach. And an orderly approach is going to be very difficult to square with an absence of accepted international law. China is going to become the majority shareholder. Traditionally, obviously, the Americans were, because they invented it, arguably, although actually it was Brit, but we know what we mean. But I think certainly removing governance from America and democratizing governance, which has been a high objective of the Chinese, is increasingly going to be realized and is just the first stage in the process as they see it. We all employ cyber surveillance in internal security, but sovereignty does seem to be the key where our discussions with the Chinese are concerned. That's it.
Thank you so much, Dr. Boothby, for that. Please give a big hand for Dr. Boothby first. So in 40 minutes, we have done this major feat of summarizing the telling.